From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, James Burnett, editorial director of The Trace, discusses what it will take to end America's gun violence crisis. Actor Chadwick Boseman on his role in the movie Marshall, and singer Michael McDonald looks back on his career and discusses his new album. It's called Wide Open. But first, on December 12, voters in Alabama will decide who they want to take over the Senate seat that was previously held by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Alabama is traditionally safe Republican territory, but analysts are paying attention to the Democratic candidate, Doug Jones. He's running against the controversial Republican candidate, Roy Moore. Mr. Jones is a former U.S. attorney whose campaign has received support from Vice President Joe Biden, amongst others. Doug Jones, good to have you on the program.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Tavis. It's good to be back.
Good to have you back on this program. Let me start by explaining to the audience why this race is so important and why it's being talked about so much. One, it's important because it's a U.S. Senate race. All U.S. Senate races are important, but this is the seat to replace Jeff Sessions, who is now the Attorney General. This is also the seat in the state of Alabama where Donald Trump was a few weeks ago when he called those NFL players SOBs. While he was there campaigning for Senator Luther Strange, Donald Trump was throwing, to my mind, red meat out to a red state. Trump's candidate, Senator Strange, lost to the former Supreme Court Chief Justice Roy Moore. So he's the Republican nominee. Doug Jones is the Democratic nominee. So this fight in Alabama is going to be a dogfight, and we will see what happens come December 12th. That said, to the national audience, Doug, for them to get a better understanding of why this seat is so critical and the role that Trump and others have played in making sure this seat stays Republican, give me your sense of how you read Trump coming to town, of the Trump, the comments that he made. Just give me your sense as an Alabaman, what you made of all of that as a Democratic Senate candidate.
You know, well, Tavis, you know, I think that one thing that people need to remember is that the president's got a lot of support in Alabama. Unfortunately, I think his comments were just out of line. You don't come to any state and use that kind of language, talking about anybody who is protecting their First Amendments, exercising their First Amendment, without also talking about the reasons behind that. I was very disappointed in the president's comments. We knew he was coming to campaign for his candidate in the race. At the end of the day, I don't think it really mattered very much. It didn't make a lot, but it made a lot of national news, and it once again put Alabama in a bad light when I thought it was just completely unnecessary.
You know something about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. You know something about fighting for people's human rights. We've known each other for years, and we became friends in part around your work to make sure that there was justice done, finally, in that case where those four little girls were killed in the 16th Street Baptist Church. For those who don't know about your work as a U.S. attorney back then, take us back to that day and what you did in Alabama.
Sure, Tavis. Thank you for that. I mean, it was I became the United States attorney under President Clinton in 1997. And at that time, we began to reopen and investigate the 1963 bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, in which, as you said, there were four young African-American girls that died in that horrific act of domestic terrorism. We took a lot of pride in the work that we did. We did have to delay a little bit. You may remember, Tavis, that there was another bombing in Birmingham at a women's clinic in Eric Rudolph, who was on the lam for 5 years. We put that case together, and we worked with a state and local task force to help ultimately capture him and bring him to justice. But the case of the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing was one of the most fascinating and the most important cases that I'll ever work on. We had a great team that put that together. We did so with a lot of passion. I think we were able to demonstrate that justice delayed does not have to be justice denied. And we brought a sense of healing to this community and to this state, and something that was badly needed when we convicted both Tommy Blanton and Bobby Frank Cherry for the murder of those four young girls.
You were something of an icon in Alabama and around the country for those of us who care about social justice and about civil rights being honored. Why, with the status you've already achieved, having done something that nobody else could do all these decades later, why put yourself up for elective office, Doug? You've never run before. Why now?
You know, Tavis, I think it's because, you know, Washington is broken. I think both parties right now have broken the system a little bit. They don't talk to each other. They don't have the kind of dialogues that it takes to kind of bring those cases to justice with that kind of passion that we brought. It's time that somebody comes into Washington that can talk to both sides, and I think I can do that. I think I've demonstrated that in my career, not just with those cases. You remember, Tavis, I was appointed by a Republican attorney general to do those cases in state court. I can talk to both sides of the aisle. I'm running as a Democrat, but I can talk to both sides, and I think we need that. I started this campaign talking about the fact that Washington needs people that will have more dialogues instead of monologues. We hear far too much of that. And so every now and then, somebody, you just got to step out when you feel passionate about what needs to be done in this country for equality and for justice for everyone. It's time to just step up, and I had a lot of people encouraging me, and I felt like it was something, the right thing to do at this point in my career.
I know that candidates never like to mention the name of their opponent, but we know who Roy Moore is. He's been talked about, has been talked about on every major network and every major newspaper. This is a guy who was kicked out of, twice, has been removed from office as a justice in the state of Alabama, and yet he went on to beat the incumbent Senator Luther Strange, who Trump had supported. He's raised a ton of money. He's got a bunch of endorsements lined up. This is Steve Bannon's candidate in the state of Alabama. How ugly is this race going to get?
Well, you know, Tavis, I don't know how ugly it'll be. Obviously, you always want to tout your record. I'm very proud of my record, and we're going to talk about Roy Moore's record. I think he is an extremist. I don't think he fully represents all the people in Alabama. I don't think he represents a majority of the people of Alabama with his views. He certainly doesn't abide by the rule of law, has violated his oath of office and duty to the people that put him in office on two occasions. But we're going to try to run a race that's positive. I mean, we're going to talk about records, but we want to talk about issues. I think that's what one thing that we've gotten away from in Alabama, at least with the Democratic Party, is talking about issues and talking about things that people care about. I've called them the kitchen table issues. They're issues that people sit down and talk about with their spouses, with their children, their health care, their educations, the jobs, the income gap that we've seen. Those are what I think people are most concerned about these days. And I think we've got an opportunity with this special election to really focus on issues more than personalities, although that is certainly going to be a part of the dialogue that we have going forward.
So the analysts say that you have to win the black vote. No doubt about that. You're going to pull that, and I suspect you're going to pull it in big numbers given what you've done to bring justice to those families in Alabama. You get the black vote, but I'm also reading that you need to put about 30% of the white vote in a very red state. Can you do that?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. I think we'll do better than that. You know, people in this state, Tavis, are tired. We've been embarrassed before. Roy Moore is one of the embarrassments of this state, having been removed from office twice. We've had Speaker of the House, the governor, all removed from office. People are looking for new leadership. They're looking for genuine, honest leadership. And I think that's the biggest thing. People don't like extremists on either side of the aisle. And that's what Roy Moore is. Certainly he has a base, but I've got a base too, and it's pretty strong. We believe that we've got a lot of crossover votes, people that are not satisfied with the way things are going with Roy Moore and his candidacy. People want to really see somebody that's going to reach out. They want to see somebody that they can talk to, even if they don't agree with them 100% of the time. And you and I have had these conversations before. We can sit down at that table, and we can talk to people, and we can agree to disagree on many things. I absolutely believe that the people of the state have a lot more in common than we have that divide us. Those are the issues that we're going to be talking about.
The Democratic Party, I've had my critique of them of late in the aftermath of what happened in the presidential election. How supportive of your candidacy is the party going to be? On the one hand, you deserve their support, you've earned their support, and yet the Democratic Party is always timid about putting money in states where they think they can't win. No Democratic president has won Alabama since, what, Jimmy Carter? What was that, 60 years ago? Carter won in Alabama. No Democrat has won since then. They always elect Republicans in Alabama. So how supportive of your candidacy, given that you've got this race really tight right now, are the Democrats going to stand behind you?
Well, I think we're going to get support from around the country in a lot of different quarters, Tavis. When you look at my campaign and when you look and see what we're talking about, it's the very issues that the Democratic Party should be talking about across the country. Again, the kitchen table issues. I think when people start talking about health care, and I do believe that this health care debate that we saw last summer has really allowed people to focus on the issues rather than parties. That has allowed people to see what is important to them on a daily basis. You know, in this state, We're seeing rural hospitals closing because we haven't expanded Medicaid. Those are the issues that the National Democratic Party should be talking about. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the Alabama issues. And if those are the issues that our party wants to jump on board with, I think they'll do it. If they don't, we're still going to work. We're going to be an independent voice for the people of the state of Alabama regardless.
30 seconds left here, Doug. The problem or the challenge that one has when one runs for an office that has become nationalized is that you're right, the focus gets away from what really matters to Alabamans. So are you going to be more hurt, or is Roy Moore going to be more hurt by this race being nationalized?
I think there'll be national interest. I don't think that will make the race nationalized. We're going to focus on those Alabama issues, and we're going to go straight to the people and talk about them. I think if there is anything that makes this nationalized, it's going to be on the other side. The people that are the extremists that support Roy Moore, they may want to make it nationalized. They're the ones trying to upset the apple cart. We're going to be talking about issues that are going to people in the state of Alabama that's going to be right down their lane that they're going to care about. So we'll see how this goes, but I'm real comfortable in how we're going to keep this race focused on Alabama.
Doug Jones, we wish you all the best. Good to have you on the program. I suspect we'll do this again, perhaps between now and December, certainly after December, if all things go well. Good to have you on. All the best to you, sir.
Thank you so much, Tavis. Great being with you.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Will the mass shooting of concertgoers in Las Vegas by Stephen Paddock finally motivate lawmakers to introduce laws that will reduce gun violence? Our next guest, James Burnett, the editorial director of The Trace. It's a news outlet dedicated to expanding coverage of guns. He joins us now to talk about the latest news and suggest some potential solutions. James, good to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Let me start by asking, how is it that one can even be nonpartisan these days on guns?
So it's certainly an issue with very strong opinions on both sides. And we're journalists.
Right.
And so that's just a fundamental thing. But we do think there's some objective truths here. And so since Las Vegas, I was just looking at the numbers from an organization called the Gun Violence Archive. Mm-hmm. They're a nonprofit. They've got a team of researchers. They create something close to a real-time count mm-hmm. of gun violence in America. So 800 more people shot since Las Vegas.
Hold on. 800 more shootings since Vegas, like a week ago.
Like a week ago, not all fatal. It's 250 fatal.
Yeah.
And that's not going to count suicides because those don't show up in media accounts
right.
and other places. So, we think that's a big number.
That's a lot of shootings, yeah.
Right, that's a big number. And as horrifying as something like a Las Vegas is to so many people in the country, it's one piece of it. It's a little bit like looking at the front part of a forest fire. If you come up and get the aerial view, right, it's so much bigger. So
that raises two questions. One, and I'm not naive in asking the first, which is why we only seem to pay attention then when these issues of gun violence are sensationalized like what we saw in Vegas.
And I think that's something that we wrestle with. I think that it can feel, I don't know, routine or accepted, mm-hmm. but we have become accustomed to it. In some ways, the numbers are lower, so the mm-hmm. homicide rate for the nation has dipped. We try to look at some of the communities, some of the neighborhoods where the number hasn't come down and where the effects are just so much higher than they are in other places.
Let me ask this another way. Do you think that except for and unless and until something like a Vegas happens, that we become anesthetized to gun violence in this country?
We might be anesthetized. I mean, I think, look, it's not fun, for lack of a better word, right? This is an upsetting subject. Mm-hmm. I think there is a natural tendency to tune it out after a while. Yeah.
Some would argue, though, not upsetting enough. Not upsetting enough to do anything about it.
That's right. And I think that there hasn't been a consensus around a particular solution. We would probably say, nor should there be. Mm-hmm. This is a complicated issue. And the interventions, they're going to need to be a bunch of different things that you would try. But yes, so far you haven't seen the kind of movement or tipping point federally. If the question is, why haven't we done something?
I want to take that word consensus and sort of unpack that, James. I can appreciate the fact that on this issue that is so controversial and where there are such disparate opinions, we might never reach a consensus. But we don't even need consensus. We need like 50 plus one to get something done in one body of Congress. Why can't we even get to that threshold? If we never get to consensus, we can't even get to 51?
So far, I mean, that hasn't been the case. And if you look back, so the last time that we had a big national moment, a big federal moment in Washington, D.C., was after the Sandy Hook school shooting. And yes, that was a time where there was a bill introduced that would have expanded the number of situations or scenarios during which someone would need to go through a background check to buy a gun. Right now, if it's a licensed dealer, yes. If it's an unlicensed dealer through a private sale or an unlicensed seller at a gun show, no, right? So they were going to expand that. That didn't pass because we didn't have the numbers that you would need to get that through.
If America doesn't get serious after a bunch of white kids, it's one thing to dismiss kids of color getting killed. It's another thing to dismiss gun violence in communities of color. But when white babies get gunned down at school, if America doesn't have the courage to do anything about gun violence, then my sense is it ain't never gonna happen. I raise that only because it appears that I may be wrong. Appears is the key phrase, key word. It appears I may be wrong about that assessment, because if I'm to believe what I read, the NRA may have just taken a step backward or forward, depending how one looks at it, on these bump stocks, which we saw, which we have seen, of course, come into debate since the Vegas shooting. So am I right or am I wrong about the fact that something may be about to happen, if only on bump stocks?
Well, so it's the something's going to matter here, so and the devil's in the details.
Okay.
What the NRA said was after these bump stock devices, so these are devices that let a semi-automatic rifle shoot basically like an automatic rifle, what we think of as a machine gun. Those are very strictly regulated and restricted. Semi-automatic rifles you can buy in big box stores and widely available. So you take a thing that is not very well regulated or widely regulated and turn it into something strictly controlled, and 58 dead, around 500 injured through bullet wounds or while escaping. These devices, these bump stocks, they don't have a, there's not a big community behind them. There are some people who like to use them. They don't have the kind of self-defense application where you could say, oh, this is something that's part of sort of routine self-defense gun ownership. So they don't have a constituency, a strong constituency behind them. And we see what happened in Las Vegas, and it's just hard to defend them, right? So, but what the NRA has said was we should look at those again. The ATF, which regulates and polices guns in America, should look at those. They classified those. They said, you know, what is this? Is this a duck or is this a goose? Is this a gun or a gun accessory? It's an accessory, the ATF decided. So it's not our jurisdiction, basically, right? NRA says, ATF, take another look. Congress, don't vote. We don't want you to vote on that. In fact, what we want you to vote on is a separate piece of legislation, a very different piece of legislation. The technical term is concealed carry reciprocity. Basically says that if you have a gun permit from Arizona, it should be good in California, whether Arizona or whether California wants it to be or not, and so on, and you know, down the line, basically removing the authority for states to decide whose permits they can accept. That's what the NRA really wants to vote on. That's what they've said after Las Vegas.
I'm just a country boy, but that sounds like bait and switch to me. it sounds like they put out this statement about bump stocks to get our attention that the NRA is doing the right thing now. But what I thought I heard you say, though, is what they're voting on, what they want Congress to vote on, something totally different, which would actually expand, not reduce or shrink, access to guns.
That's correct.
Or use of guns
or
in various states.
Guns, right.
Use of guns.
There'd be a use of guns question.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And, you know, that's your categorization of it's a bait and switch or what
it's
you
bait
call
and switch. But James can't say it, but Tavis just did.
But it's not, it's certainly not as straightforward as some big grand bargain around this one product or category. It's, in fact, kind of punting it back to the ATF so you deal with it. And Democrats who want a law said, we need a new statute. We need to make this clear. And so we need a vote. It's a role of Congress to pass a new law here. So that's what the fight is. And it's really technical. But the bigger question is, you know, should we have a big debate about regulating these products
I'm all for regulating bump stocks. But it sounds to me like, again, it's much ado about nothing. If there's not a large community here, number one, I mean, it's the right thing to do, but if you're talking about 10 or 12 people, what difference does it ultimately make? And if the NRA says we want not Congress to look at it, but the ATF to look at it. And the ATF is saying it ain't our purview.
Right.
That's what I define as much ado about nothing.
Sure. Yeah. And what we're talking about, if it is the ATF, it's a regulatory review process, that's going to take some time.
Right.
There are some things they can do in the reinterpretation of the definition of the law. But this isn't swift public debate in Congress. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of thing that probably diffuses attention. And we came back to what we talked about at the beginning of the conversation. You know, is the country really engaged with this issue? Some people certainly are, but on a day-to-day basis, many people are not. And so, you know, that's the cycle we might see play out here, is that it'll sort of, the temperature will come down a little bit.
Yeah.
It becomes a regulatory issue, and, you know,
and
we move on.
Exactly. So you just said something that's very powerful to me, James, I think, which is that we can point the finger at Congress or leaders in Washington for not doing anything. But ultimately, it sounds to me like what you're saying is that a lot of this responsibility falls on the American public, because we do have the agency to do something about it. And so this cooling off period is not just a cooling off period that happens in Washington, but the NRA and those who support guns and more access to guns know full well that it's just a matter of news cycles before the American public writ large moves on to something else and no longer holds them accountable.
That may be the strategy or the play here. Yeah. I was going to cite quickly something we looked at.
Please,
it was a study done after Sandy Hook, and they looked and they broke it down demographically by gender and whether you were basically pro-gun rights or pro-gun reform. Mm-hmm. And pro-gun men were the most vocal across a number of political behaviors, giving money, contacting your congressman, expressing your
pro-gun
views. Pro-gun men.
Are the most active on the gun question.
They were the most active on the gun question.
Okay.
And what happened was that voice was sort of loudest and most energized, and then there wasn't new legislation passed. Now, you know, since then, there have been efforts, and I would say momentum, I think, is probably a fair categorization on the gun control side or the gun violence prevention side to get more organized, to have more of a grassroots presence. But, you know, for people who are very strongly pro-gun, a lot of times it's an identity question. I mean, it's kind of becomes core to their being, because the gun has become their means for protection. There's a really smart book about this called Citizen Protectors, where this sociologist spends a bunch of time with men who are concealed carry permit holders and feel themselves in a protector role, where maybe they were a provider role. That's her thesis before. Mm. So, but when you come down to it, it's a very strongly held feelings, and maybe we don't have quite the intensity of feeling on the pro-reform side, where it becomes just your identity and you will go to the mat for that one question.
There you have it, America. For them, it's about identity, but for me, it's about humanity. And so long as the folk who hold their identity, who think their identity is wrapped around their guns, as long as they're the loudest voices and the most active, not just by being loudest, but to your point, if they're the loudest and the most active around their identity, and those of us who care about the whole of humanity are less loud and less active, this question will never get answered. James Burnett, good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Actor Chadwick Boseman is best known for playing American heroes. His film roles include baseball legend Jackie Robinson in the film 42 and James Brown in Get On Up. He's also the star of the highly anticipated Marvel movie Black Panther. His current project is called Marshall. It centers around Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American Supreme Court justice, in one of his career-defining cases. Before our conversation with Chadwick, hear now a clip from the film Marshall.
Mr. Spell, I'm Thurgood Marshall with the NAACP. You heard of us.
You a lawyer?
I am. This is Sam Friedman. He's a lawyer, too.
Hey, you can go. Got no money for lawyers.
Anybody ask you for money? Did you rape that woman, Joseph?
No.
Why does she say you did?
I don't know why she's saying that.
She says you raped her and tried to kill her.
She's lying.
I'm telling you this up front. The NAACP were not like most lawyers. We only represent innocent people, people accused because of their race. That's our mission. You understand? So I need to know this. Look at me now. Did you do what they said you did?
I never touched that woman.
Okay, Joseph. You got lawyers now.
So I know this ain't the first time you've heard this, but you just cornering the market on our heroes. You just caught her in the market.
Hey, it's open for everybody else to do it too.
No, not as long as you're in town, because you keep sucking them up.
Yeah.
There obviously must be some sort of joy, because I think it's more than just coincidental that you're playing these heroes. What's that about for you?
The process is always enjoyable. And scary at the same time because you know there's so much expectation when you play someone that is someone else's hero, when you play someone that is someone else's father or grandfather. Mm-hmm. But the process is always so rewarding because you know that you're giving people a sense of history. People will go and then do their own research and find what is exactly like the movie and what is not like the movie. They'll find the other, in this case, other cases that Thurgood Marshall might have tried. You know, a lot of people know Brown versus the Board of Education, and they know that he was the first African-American Supreme Court justice, but they don't know the full extent of his impact. So the fact that you're giving people a glimpse inside and you know that they will also get this other wealth of things from it, that is a beautiful thing as well. So.
I can't imagine, I'm gonna put you on the spot for a second, but I know you can handle it. I can't imagine that you play characters like these and you, long after they say that's a wrap, don't take something away from these characters.
Right.
Let me put you on the spot. What'd you take away from Jackie Robinson?
Oh, I mean, it's funny that you say it that way because I find myself pulling from not just these characters, but from my parents. You know, when I need to do certain things, I pull from my father, I pull from my mother, I pull from my uncles, I pull from my brothers.
Right.
But these characters actually have given me another avenue of things that I can pull from. So there's a certain amount of courage that you get from playing Jackie Robinson that you didn't have before. You can walk into spaces that you maybe you think you don't belong, but you're gonna go anyway.
Yeah.
Because that is exactly what he did. Yeah. You know, I think there's a certain amount of providence that he had that allowed him to deal with the situations that he had to undergo. And so you find yourself checking yourself for how you're living because he had to be perfect.
Yeah.
You know, he had to be spotless in certain cases, and I fall short, but I'm trying.
Yeah.
You know, James Brown, there's a certain audacity that comes from playing James Brown that I end up saying, that there'll be certain moments, all my friends know it, that when I have to say things that are difficult, I might have said it before, but I wouldn't have done it in that way. Mm-hmm. And so somehow I can say things now that are uncomfortable or that would make people upset, and now people don't get upset because I throw a little James Brown in there. You know, because it's always like, it could have been worse than it was.
Oh, yeah. I can see that.
It could have been worse.
I can see that.
You know, and I would say for Thurgood Marshall, it's you know, I walked into this not knowing who he was and not knowing there's an audacity that he had as well. And there is a certain swagger that he had in order to walk in situations. He exists in a space where you're like, did he just do that? Mm-hmm. Like, did he actually just, you know, there's stories about him, you know, arguing cases in the South, and people would come and they just wanted to see him do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no matter what side of it they were on, they wanted to see this Negro lawyer, you know, argue this case. It was entertaining. And I think there's the sense of flair, the sense of the dramatic that he was able to always create, and it served him well. So there's all of those things. I think there's a certain amount of selflessness I think he had, because he lived in a, he could have lived in a comfortable place to a certain degree, but he was driven by this goal to make America better than it was.
Yeah. There's an old adage that that we see people's glory, but we don't know their backstory.
Right.
See the glory, we know the backstory. When you get a chance to play somebody like Thurgood Marshall, what do you come to appreciate about the backstory of any person who's great, the part that we don't see, the part that we don't know before they wind up on the Supreme Court or whatever their apex moment is?
Yeah, the thing that, and I always want the younger audience to know this about Thurgood Marshall. He wasn't the best student growing up. He had to find his way once he got to college. You know, he was the guy that missed out on class because he wanted to party. Mm-hmm. He was the guy that spent more time playing cards and drinking bourbon and smoking cigarettes and all that stuff. And that was him. You know what I'm saying? He was more focused on a fraternity than he was. He was a practical joker. That's who he was. And so I appreciate that because a lot of times people get caught up in how we're tested in school, how the educational system sort of values one student over another. And I've taught, I've taught students. I've taught students theater, taught them Africana studies. And it's like, I always look at that student and I go, okay, he's smart. He's the he's the one that's actually smarter than everybody else. Mm-hmm. But he's too smart for his own good. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate the fact that Thurgood Marshall was that guy and he actually found his way and then he found a way to use it in his practice, in his service. He found how to use, that's the reason why actually, he could get all of the alpha personalities in one room, all the best attorneys who would argue on his particular side of a case, hear their differences of opinion and battle it out, let iron sharpen iron. And he could galvanize that group of people together because of that personality, because they wanted to be in the room with him. They wanted to have the cigarette with him after, or they wanted to have the bourbon, and they wanted to be around his personality while they did those things. So they would do it for nothing, just to be there.
Before I let you get out of here in 3 minutes, this Black Panther project is everywhere. I was just talking to a friend of mine the other day, a guy named Art Sims, who did the poster for the Black Panther thing. He showed it to me, just excited about it. And I'm glad to see that Art was doing that. But it's like everybody's talking about this. And I suspect it's just a matter of time before you have kids all over the country just being proud of.
I hope so.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Like we were at Comic-Con and I was seeing, it's not even just Black kids, it's white kids, Latino kids, Asian kids, little girls that are Black Panthers. And there's a lot of great female characters within our movie too, which I love. It's definitely cutting edge. So I'm proud of it. I can't really say more than about it.
You see, I didn't ask you nothing about it. You know it's there, right? But I didn't ask you a question.
But I'm proud of people. I'm proud of the fact that people are excited about it.
The balance. You play these real life heroes, and now you play this, comic book character. That balance must be.
They help each other.
Yeah, I'm gonna say that.
They for me as an actor, it gives me balance. Mm-hmm. Because you don't want to be in the superhero suit all the time. Mm-hmm. And the character itself, I have to say that Black Panther, he's not just a superhero, he's also the head of a state. Mm-hmm. Head of state, he's a king. Mm-hmm. So you get that inside the movie, but at the same time, being able to step into you know, the role of Thurgood Marshall. Even I did this movie that was just on Netflix that's doing really well on Netflix, A Message from the King. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a small art house thriller. Mm-hmm. They all help with the process, like the process of playing a real person, the process of playing someone that's, you know, completely fantasy. You're able to bring truth to the fantasy, yeah, and fantasy to the real, because you're doing both things.
Yeah. He's a bad man. He's playing superheroes and real life heroes. His latest turn is playing Thurgood Marshall in the film Marshall, which you can catch all around the country. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Singer-songwriter Michael McDonald has had a distinguished and eclectic career, best known for his work with the Doobie Brothers. His hits include the Grammy-winning song What a Fool Believes and I Keep Forgetting. He has collaborated with a variety of artists, including Aretha Franklin, Patti LaBelle, and recently bass player and producer Thundercat. Now he's back with a new album. It's called Wide Open. Michael McDonald, good to have you back on this program.
Thanks, Tavis. Great to be back.
Good to see you, my friend. Where you been? I've seen you in that 17-year
at
period.
At my age, that's a loaded question. You know?
I've seen you, of course, in that 17-year period, but it's hard to believe 17 years since an album of all original stuff.
That's right. Yeah. Well, that's the issue, I guess. In fact, most of this stuff was written during the time I did the three Motown records.
Oh yeah.
The Motown record label, and so
you sold a few of those.
Yeah. it gave me a chance to kind of catch up with my writing a little bit.
Yeah. Does writer's block ever set in for you, or you've never had that?
Every day. It's a kind of an ongoing thing with me. You know.
Yeah.
I can take 4 years to write a song. You know, and I think I have actually.
Yeah. What's that about with you? Like, why is it? Is that just your way? It just takes a little longer, or?
Yeah, I think it's just my way of doing things. I've actually had people get mad at me that I wrote with over the years because I just take longer than I probably should. But what I found was, and the reason I do that is, even with some of the songs on this record, songs I started 8 years ago, I was changing lines, you know, as we were mixing the thing and jumping out and, you know, punching in vocal lines, and I mean, not that often, but I do it enough, and it always seems like that song just wasn't quite written until that moment, you know, and in the way that I would have liked it to have been written. Does it really make a difference, or would anybody know the difference but me? I don't know, but it seems like, you know, things are, I'm a real believer with songs that they're finished when they're finished. You know?
And, I told my team, you took long enough that vinyl came back.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's how long you've been out. That vinyl is back in now.
And don't we love that?
Yeah, we do love it. Yeah. What do you make of the fact that in your career, you've seen this stuff come and go and come again?
Well, I think vinyl is back because it's still a relevant medium. You know, I think it still sounds better.
Than
in some ways digital sounds better, and digital's come a long way, and it's really neck and neck.
Right.
But I think there are certain things about vinyl,
like
not the least of which is beautiful harmonic distortion. You know, that we grew up, we were used to that. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think and there's a warmth, and there's also the third dimension with vinyl because it's analog.
Yeah.
And so we mixed this record, we did it as much analog all the way as we could, and when we mixed actually two analog tape and digital medium.
Yeah.
And the engineer sat me down, he said, now listen to both mixes, and the digital mix was beautiful.
Yeah.
When he put on the analog mix, the half inch tape, I could actually hear the drums reflect off the back wall.
Yeah.
And that's something you don't get with digital. Your brain fills that in, but you don't really hear it.
Yeah. You know? Tell me about the decision to call it Wide Open.
I think for me, initially what it meant was I'd often thought that there was all kinds of music that I wrote and that I didn't normally do. Mm-hmm. You know, typically with the Doobies, my job, when I kind of got to be at least familiar to any audience, was as a keyboard player with the Doobie Brothers.
Yeah.
And I don't really play guitar that well, but I always wrote on guitar, mm-hmm, as much as keyboard. And even played guitar in a band, you know, not well, but you know, I when I was a kid. And so I always felt that there was an area of my writing that I didn't really make records with, you know. And so with this record, I kind of made a concerted effort to figuring, hey, this could be my last for all I know. I want to put it all out there.
What is that arena or that avenue that you tapped into that you hadn't written from, that space?
I think mostly just music I wrote on guitar, that seems to take on a different chordal harmonic structure and, right. And you know, they're all different vehicles for me, you know, as a songwriter. You know, a keyboard allows me to do certain things musically that I don't play guitar well enough to do, and yet vice versa, guitar allows me to approach a song in a different way that is hard to do on piano, you know, and or keyboards.
Yeah.
So you know, I'm one of those like the old saying. I do it all, but none of it that well.
You're being a little too modest, I think. Obviously, we've had this conversation so many times over the years. You know, I'm a huge Doobie Brothers fan, a huge Michael McDonald fan, and I was so tickled, and it was so cool just to see how much, how people appreciate your work and how the generations appreciate your work. I saw you kill it at Coachella,
and that
stuff's on YouTube everywhere. But I was really tickled to see Solange performing with you, What a Fool Believes.
Absolutely.
That must have been cool, hanging out with the...
It was amazing, you know, I knew she was on the bill, and my daughter, you know, was calling me constantly that day, you know, and honey, I'm at rehearsal, you know, I can't, she goes, have you seen her yet, you know? I don't know that I will, you know?
Yeah.
The next thing I know, one of the guys in the band I was rehearsing with said, you know, I know Solange, you know, she's a fan of your music, and you should get her up to sing on something.
Yeah.
I said, well, I'd love her to come up. So apparently they went and mentioned it to her, and she was sweet enough to come out, and we rehearsed What a Fool Believes, and she killed it, you know? And, I was a hero with my daughter. Yeah, for at least a week. After that.
The things that your kids would go for.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
you hang out with Solange.
Dad
is a hero for a few days.
Dad was hip for a while.
I saw you talking to my assistant, Danny Miles Davis. Danny is from Missouri. You're from Missouri, and you guys were chatting about the fact that both of you guys lived in Ferguson. From Ferguson.
I am from Ferguson.
And Danny at one point lived in Ferguson, being from St. Louis. I haven't talked to you about this, but so much has happened since then, and so much sadly continues to happen between cops and citizens, and that's not to demean all cops, of course, but how have you processed all of this stuff over the last few years, given that you are from Ferguson?
Well, it's really caused me to think more widely about my experience growing up there.
You know? Right.
In this country, people are exposed to so little of what really goes on with everyone in this country. You know, when I grew up in St. Louis, it was this country was in a state of apartheid. You know, it was the 50s. You know, you wouldn't have seen a black person walk down the main street. You know, and then I realized that I remembered being a kid. You know, when I was like maybe 4 or 5, some of my earliest recollections were. God, are they going to drop the bomb, you know, because we all heard about the bomb.
Sure, sure.
And wrestling with the idea of, well, what if I'd been born black? You know, what if? You know, it's 50-50 as far as I could tell. There's no, you know, prerequisite or, you know, you either are or you're not. And I struggled with, you know, what does a black kid do on like a day like today? Who would I know in my family? Who would even speak to me? Who would I cross paths with? Could I walk into the Dairy Queen? You know, sounds silly, but
no, not silly.
But when you realize that here's a 4-year-old kid, it made me realize that there's something amazing about the fact that when we're that young, we see the injustice in it. We understand that there's something wrong, and it's something that adults should be able to fix.
Well, your generation was supposed to fix all this. Your generation was supposed to not pass on racism.
We thought that's right. Isn't that the truth? We really believed that we would be the generation that didn't burden the next generation with racism and needless hatred and toxic fear, you know, because that kind of hatred is only based on ignorance and toxic fear. I don't care what you say, how you try to describe it, how you try to rationalize it. That's all it is, you know. We are all in this together. And, you know, this whole thing about America great again, you know, America wasn't so great for a lot of people, you know. And America's on the road to getting great, to living up to its own constitution. Mm-hmm. And I have every belief that it will. You know, in times like we're going through right now, that are as turbulent as they've ever been, I believe these are the growth spurts that are leading us to greatness. Mm-hmm. You know, I like to believe that anyway. Yeah.
I want to circle back to your new project, Wide Open. Talk to me about the content on this project.
You know, it's funny, in hindsight, with a lot of the songs, when I wrote them, even up until the time we mixed the record, I don't think I was even all that aware of what they meant mm-hmm. personally, you know. I always have a habit of like taking some kind of a personal thought or emotional concept and putting it into a framework that I think people will easily relate to, and mm-hmm. it typically is man and a woman, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. But like a song like Hail Mary, there's probably more of my own inner feelings in that song, not necessarily having to do with a man and a woman so mm-hmm. much as just that feeling of being this age, and you know, I'm surprised at being this age. I think most of us, when you get to be 65, you're kind of surprised at who you are at 65. I thought I would be happy to be in front of a television falling asleep, you yeah. know, and that's what my life would be, and I'd be okay with that, you know. Yeah. And then you realize that you're still in there somewhere, you know, mm-hmm. and you'd like to run it into the end zone one more time, yeah. even if it's only in your own mind, you yeah. know. And that's kind of, for some reason, it catches us by surprise at this age. When I was making this record, I still had all the drive and passion to get together with my friends and make music and catch that take, you know, on the yeah. fly. Even though I was also the guy driving in the left-hand lane at 40 miles an hour with my blinker stuck on, you know, you know, there's no getting around that. But you know, or the guy you don't want to encounter on the parking lot.
Yeah.
You know? But nonetheless, you know, I still like to rock and roll, and yeah. and hit a groove, so that in a way, that song is kind of about that for me too. Is just you know, that old Hail Mary
yeah.
pass.
The name of the new project. From Michael McDonald. It's called Wide Open. His first new project of all original stuff in 17 years. And if you're a Michael McDonald fan like I am, you are going to love it. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel N.C. Abwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.